We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Welcome to Special Edition, a weekly look at the issues in the news and the personality shaping the stories. Special Edition is a production of Intercom Communications.
Welcome to Special Edition. I'm Paula Degnan. On this week's Special Edition, we'll be hearing from Josh Naur. He is a former White House advisor on data gathering. He's going to talk about how earlier this week, the Trump administration announced that it mandated hospitals to go around the Centers for Disease Control and begin sending information on equipment and hospitalizations directly to the Department of Health and Human Services. That move has caused quite a bit of controversy and a lot of discussion. Josh will weigh in from his perspective. Also today on Special Edition, we'll be hearing from Senator John Udichak and State Representative Aaron Coffer. They got together earlier this week and made an announcement that will bring jobs to Pennsylvania. And speaking of jobs, so many have changed since the coronavirus pandemic began back in March. One of those that has had a lot of changes, those who do hair. And we're going to talk with Barbara Stemple. She is a hairdresser from the Whitehaven area, and she's going to tell us how things have changed in her business. Wilkes-Barre Mayor George Brown will join Intercom's Jason Barsky to tell us about the newly created Police Advisory Committee. But we're going to start things off right now by introducing you to Dom Perini of Jessup Hose Company No. 2. Feeling hungry, like you'd like to get out and have some of those wonderful foods that you enjoy from the Midway? Well, they are having a Midway Food Festival. It began earlier this week. It wraps up this weekend. There's still time to get there. Dom caught up with Intercom's Webster and gave us all the details about it.
Friend from Jessup Hose Company No. 2, it's Dom Perini. Mr. Perini, good morning to you, sir. Long time no chat.
Good morning to you also. It's such a privilege to always speak to you.
The background information, obviously, Jessup Hose Company No. 2, it coincides with both Memorial Day and St. Ubaldo weekend. You guys put on the big carnival and picnic, which is always the biggest and the best, and really the unofficial kickoff to summer. Obviously, circumstances dictated that wasn't possible this year, okay? And that was a huge disappointment for a lot of people, yourself included, certainly. So now, I guess, and you've come up with a plan here, which I think is a nice solution and sort of a midway point, because we're green phase now. We're on our way back and it's feeling good. And, you know, it's a little touchy feely a little bit, but something that maybe takes us back to a little bit closer to where we want to be. And that's something you're calling the Midway Food Festival. So tell us about that.
Well, I'm not going to take credit for this one, okay? I got a call from the carnival owner, Mr. Yeah. Swyka,
right,
months ago, and he said, look, we're really dying. He said, all the events have been canceled. We're canceled right through the end of the year now. Mm-hmm. He said, and we're hemorrhaging. He said, we're trying to think of something to do to pick up a couple dollars where at least we could pay maybe some of our insurance expenses, mm-hmm, or something to keep our heads above water so that we all don't go bankrupt. He said, and what we wanted to do is reach out to all our good spots and see if we could set up some food trailers and generate some revenue for ourselves. We'll, of course, give you guys a commission for hosting us and putting us on your lot, but we really need to generate some income. And for everything that they've done for us over the years, we just said, go for it.
Absolutely. And well, you know, when you
mentioned how it happened,
the economic and financial hardships that the pandemic has created, I mean, that a lot of people are aware of what's going on there, and there are no strangers to that. And a lot of people took it on the chin because of it. Certainly the carnival bit, S&S Amusements we're talking about here. S&S Amusements, the premier carnival attractions in all of Northeast Pennsylvania, probably in a good chunk of the state, actually. And so with, you know, everybody and their brother has having to cancel things like this, I can imagine their schedule will dissolve right before their eyes. So this seems like a nice solution to the problem here in terms of at least regaining some of that revenue and also being able to provide for the folks who enjoy the picnic and the carnival a way to sort of get a little taste of it again. So tell us.
Yeah, and it's mostly, you know, the carnival-driven food, like you're going to have your funnel cakes and you're going to have your elephant ears and you're going to have your French fries and your cotton candy and candy apples, et cetera, ice cream. Is there. You know, of course, I'm disappointed we couldn't make tripe for you, Johnny. I mean, we could have, you know. But we wanted to let the Midway speak. We wanted to let the carnival food speak for itself. But we did manage to call our potato pancake guy back. We had, even though he's not a part of S&S Amusements, S&S works with him very closely.
Right.
That's Yogi Pancakes that we've had for the last 20-some years. And I called Michael, the owner of that now, and I said, look, would you like to be a part of this? And he said, absolutely. So homemade potato pancakes are there.
Well, you know, and you just rattled off a list of crowd-pleasing favorites there, and, you know, getting back to tripe, and I've been asking Johnny to put a good word in about the tripe, but I understand how the focus is on the Midway and the carnival vendors and the food festival and all that. But listen, I'm hanging in there. You know, next year rolls around, I'm ready for the tripe. And Dom, I think you know, when you guys are selling tripe, a lot of times what happens is I just either park the car or I drop my wife off and go around the block till I find a parking spot. She gets in line, and then I walk out of there with $120 worth of tripe, bring it home and put a lot of it in the freezer and enjoy it for the next couple of weeks. So, I mean, that's a crowd.
Well, as we know, tripe lovers love tripe.
Yeah, there is.
And people who can't stomach to hear it.
Oh, boy. You know, there's the beauty of it right there. When Dom Perini's got built-in tripe jokes, you know you're going to have a good time. All right, so listen, I'm looking at the Facebook page here, and you did mention a bunch of items that are on the menu, but I'm looking at a whole list here now. Sausage and peppers and pierogies and chicken fingers. And as you mentioned, Yogi's potato pancakes, always a crowd pleaser. Of course, you got the funnel cakes, fried Oreos.
It goes through Sunday, and then they're going to open Saturday and Sunday 12 to 8.
Okay.
It's a total drive-in. You drive your car in. You park your car, you get out of your car, you go buy what you want, you go back to your car. You could either eat it there, you could take it home, you could go in the back and park. We're trying to put as many spaces together with the social distancing, and the people must wear masks. If you don't bring a mask, you're not going to get out of the car. That's just the way it is.
Yes.
And we're going to try to make everybody safe, but yet have a little bit of fun.
Well, I mean, that's important, obviously. You know, you have to always err on the side of caution, and you guys are observing all the social distancing guidelines and the masks and all the rest, so that's important. Now, people be able to stop by and enjoy the Midway foods there at the Midway Food Festival.
Standing. We go back a long way.
Yes, sir, we
Mr.
do.
Mr. Webster.
There's no doubt about it. All right, so it's the Midway Food Festival, Jessup Host Company number 2 grounds there. It's right there on the foot of Hill Street there, next to the railroad tracks. Kent is, what, 12 to 8, you said, right, Don?
12 to 8, and remember, take the KC exit. Exit 3 is Jessup. No matter which exit you get off, north or south, it's all downhill from there.
I just got goosebumps. Dom, always a pleasure, man. Nice to talk to you.
You too.
Jessup Host Company number 2 grounds right there on Hill Street, right next to the railroad tracks, and it's going right through the weekend.
I believe that discussion would whet any appetite and get you ready to head to Jessup Host Company number 2 for some delicious summertime treats. And if you are heading in that direction, don't go anywhere, because coming up right now, it's Wilkes-Barre Mayor George Brown. He's looking for candidates to join the newly created Wilkes-Barre Police Advisory Committee. What is it? Who's he looking for? Where can you get an application? Intercom's Jason Barsky gets the answers.
Wilkes-Barre Mayor George Brown. police advisory committee. I wanted to let you talk about that because you're trying to find people to make up this committee. I think I know why you're doing it, but can you give the background? Why are you having a police advisory committee? What are they going to do, and who are you looking for to be on this committee?
Okay, well, let me start with your second question first. There's going to be a panel of I will be on it along with the police chief, but we will not be part of the voting. We're only advisors on the committee. Seven other people will make up the committee, and it's going to be made up of a section of every diverse part of the city of Wilkes-Barre. I want a representation from each group. It will be selected, and they will sit on this committee, and the terms will either be 5 or 3 years. And what they're going to do is actually provide a service that we need in the city. It's a service that people can come to these meetings and they can voice, you know, what their issues are, their concerns about police interactions and responses. And we're going to help to identify critical reoccurring issues of importance for the residents. We're going to facilitate changes if necessary in local law enforcement. You see, the police department reports to the mayor in a strong mayor form of government.
Mm-hmm.
I am not in favor of the other suggestion that was put out, because that's a review board that actually takes away takes away the authority of the mayor, and I don't want that, okay? They want to create something that has subpoena powers. The district attorney has subpoena powers. Our advisory committee will be something that's set up for people to come, tell us what the issues are, what their issues are with the police department, and then we can work through those things. Okay, we want to practice something for the local community that's fair, and we want to make sure that our people are treated with dignity. And also we want to make recommendations that, you know, for public safety and to promote law and order and assist in reducing crime and protect the community. This is something that's going to be a partnership between the community and this committee, where we can work together. And I want to hear from the different folks within the city of Wilkes-Barre what their issues are or may be with the police department. So this committee is going to be a great representation of the different parts of the city. We have a large Hispanic population.
Yeah.
We have a large African-American population. We have an Indian population. We have LGBT population. So I want every segment of that population to be represented on this committee.
No, that's good. I know sometimes when are you legally able to? Is it just because it's an advisory committee? Can you legally say we want certain demographics? Can you actually make it up like that? Or because I know people will say, "Well, that's not fair. I want as much of a chance as anybody else." To that, what would you say to that? I mean, I don't know what the legalities would be.
Sure. Well, what's happening is we're opening up to applications. The application is on the Wilkes-Barre City website. It's available to be downloaded and to be filled out. I want to flood my office with applications, Jason, the best way I can say that. And the first thing is to get the people to buy into what this is and then have them apply for these positions. But you have to understand something, that this is going to be a representation of the 7.3 square miles that makes up the city of Wilkes-Barre, and I want to make sure that it represents everyone. So, yeah, we can ask people to apply for it. I don't know what type of response I'm going to get. I'm hoping it's going to be very, very positive and understood that this is going to be a very important committee. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. I mean, I'll be glad to come back on in a couple of weeks and share with you the information. Let me give you another example. We have openings in the police department right now, Jason.
Yep.
I want to make sure that everyone applies for that, okay? We have 81 applications for the 3 or 4 openings that I have, and the applicants we're getting are very diverse. It shows a lot of different parts of diversity within the city, and I love that because we need a diverse police force. We also have openings in our fire department. We'll be posting these testing for that. I want to make sure that people apply that make up the segments of the Wilkes-Barre as far as fire department also, DPW.
Gotcha.
So, yes, it's important, I think, to make sure that the people that are in the city, that make up the city, are represented in these different areas.
How much commitment will these people have to give if they, take part? If they apply and they get selected, it's not a full-time job, obviously. How often do you plan on meeting? What kind of time are they going to have to put into this?
That's another great question. This is on the outline that we submitted. There'll be bi-monthly meetings every 2 months. Okay, but if it's something's necessary to meet more than that, that's fine. But we're looking at an outline of every 2 months that we'll meet.
Okay.
They're not paid positions because this is a committee, okay? Mm-hmm. A voluntary committee. It's not like other functions in the city where it's a paid position. This is not paid. This is strictly people that want to improve the city, work on building better relationships with the police in the city and the residents. So whoever applies to this, I'm glad that you mentioned this. You have to understand, folks, I don't have the money to pay for these as paid positions. These are voluntary, but I need people that care about the city, care about the way that they're treated, care about diversity, and that's what I'm looking for.
Well, that's cool. How do people get these applications to you?
They're on the Wilkes-Barre City website. They can download that. They fill it out and send it into Wilkes-Barre City Hall. I can't stress enough how much I want a lot of people applying for this committee, because I think the more people that apply, it shows that this is something that the people feel is necessary, but it's going to be work. It'll be a working process. They can download the applications from the city website.
Yeah, I'm not sure what's up with the site I usually go to, but it's not working. What is the site again? We were talking about the Police Advisory Committee.
Best way to go is type in wilkes-barre.city. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Wilkes, wilkes-barre.city.
Yeah.
And then you go to boards and authorities. You'll see a link under Citizens Action Center. You'll see a link for boards and authorities. You click on that and scroll down, and then you'll see a scroll to Wilkes-Barre Police Advisory Committee.
So it's wilkes-barre.city, and then you go to that front menu, and it's in the upper left-hand corner.
Wilkes-Barre.city.
.city, yes.
And you're going to go to boards and authorities, okay?
Now I got boards and authorities, yes.
See that?
No, I found it. Yeah, boards and authorities, and then at the very bottom it says you click on
Wilkes-Barre Police Advisory Committee.
Yes, right. It does. There it is. So, and then you can download that. When is the deadline to get these applications in?
I just opened it up just now, so I don't really have a deadline set.
Okay, cool. When do you want to get this thing up and running by?
Well, I'd like to do it soon, but it's going to really be determined by the amount of applications we get. This is something that I think is needed, Jason. It's something that I believe will be an option for our residents. I mean, it's something that I think is going to be embraced by the residents once they see how it's going to work. And we're doing other things, too. I mean, you know, we're installing the body cams on our police officers.
Right.
We're doing things that I think are going to promote what is best for the police and for the residents. So this is just one of the things that we're doing, Jason.
Yeah, Mayor George Brennan, the one thing I will say I like, one of the things I like the most, and it's a subtle thing, unless there's a story I missed, this is not coming in the wake of some sort of controversy in Wilkes-Barre with the police and a resident about an arrest. This is, hey, let's look at the world around us and try to get some people together to have these discussions so we don't ever have one of those situations. So it's not reactionary, but I guess slightly based off of the way the world is, but you're trying to start a dialogue before it seems like you're only doing it because something happened, which is what we see most often in any form of American politics and government. So I commend you for trying to do the right thing and get these people together.
Thanks, Jason. Anytime you need me to call back, I'm available.
I will remind you of that when you're mad at me for calling at 2:30 a.m.
All right, my friend. Thanks.
All right, Mayor George Brown from Wilkes-Barre.
Thanks for joining us today on Special Edition. And don't go away. There's plenty more to come. We're going to hear from State Senator John Udichak and State Representative Aaron Coffer about jobs coming to Pennsylvania. And we're also going to meet Barbara Stemple. She's a hairdresser in the Whitehaven area, and she's just getting back to work. What's changed? We'll find out when we come back. Welcome back to Special Edition. I'm Paula Degnan. Now we're going to meet Barbara Stemple. She's a hairdresser in Whitehaven and has her own shop. A lot of things have changed since March when she had to close down because of the coronavirus pandemic. More things have been put into place for her to do to keep both her and her customers safe from COVID-19. I had the opportunity to talk with Barbara about the situation and get my own hair cut at the same time.
It's a little bit different getting your hair cut with a mask on. Barbara, how have you been handling all this?
Well, it's been a little bit of a challenge, but we've got to get through it. You want to keep your clients safe, and you want to protect yourself, so it's an adjustment, but I guess we'll have to make it through.
What are some of the adjustments that you've had to make so far?
Well, only having one client at a time is a little rough, trying to figure out your scheduling, because you have to make enough time in between to be able to sanitize everything. You have to wipe down everything someone touched. Then you have to walk them out, wipe down your door handles. And we never had to do that before. We always had sanitized things, our combs, brushes, but we never had to do what we have to do now.
When all of this started, about how many clients would you say you had to reschedule?
About 50.
50?
Yep.
So how do you do that? Because anybody who knows, it takes a while to get a perm, it takes a while to get color. So that has all had to change. And you are here in the shop by yourself because you're doing this out of your own shop.
Yes. And it's not easy because you have to call them. First of all, we didn't know when we were able to open. We found out like a week before. We were watching the TV and we figured we'd be right after Corbin County. And then on a Monday, right before we opened, that Friday, they gave us the rules and regulations. So then you get on the phone and start calling everybody. And those that you couldn't get, you'd have to have them call you back. So it's been a little challenging trying to call everybody within a week to get some scheduled, and we have to work longer hours because we can't do as many people as we used to do with social distancing and only having one client per stylist.
So if I was in here getting a color right now, let's say, and somebody else wanted to come in for a cut, you wouldn't even be able to let them come in?
No. And I always worked on appointments only. And now, some places that had walk-ins, they're not allowed to take a walk-in. You have to call and make your appointment. You have to make sure nobody else is in here. And then you have to have them either wait in their car or have somewhere. And if you have a place outside for them to sit, then you have to go and sanitize it before the next person comes.
Were there other things that you had to purchase before you could reopen?
Yes, I purchased throwaway capes for all my chemical services because the other plastic ones, they take so long when you wash them to dry them. You wash them 5 times, they fall apart. So one of my friends in Wilkes-Barre, they said that there was a place where you could get the plastic and throwaway, so I did buy them, and I found out they worked pretty good, so I ordered a lot more because I was afraid that they would sell out and I wouldn't be able to get them. So I ordered 100 more, and hopefully they'll last me a little while.
How has it been, because again, I know just knowing you, it's always a good time to come in here and find out what's going on and to chat.
Now you have to rush the person out of here. Because you need to take a breather in between to take your mask off. And then you feel terrible because all my clients are mostly friends also because I've been doing it over 30 years. And now you can't give them a cup of coffee if they're sitting here with a chemical service because they can't take their mask off.
And when we're talking about people coming back, how have you been dealing with those who have quarantine hair and have been attempting to do it on their own?
Well, thank goodness I didn't get any corrective colors yet. A couple of my clients called and asked what kind of box color should they buy because they didn't want to mess up their hair. And some of them, they just said, the heck with it. They put on headbands or a hat. So it hasn't been too bad.
What about corrective cuts?
Well, that's a little challenging, especially if they took a chunk out, because then they'd say they couldn't get their sideburns right, so they just cut it off, and you work with it.
So what do you have to say now to all the people who are starting to come back and who are, you know, because I know you have been very cautious, and you continue to be very cautious.
Yes. Well, you just have to tell them when you call for their appointment, tell them make sure they wear a mask. I have signs on my doors, and if they don't go to the sanitizer, I go to them. And it's a little bit challenging because so far nobody has complained about the mask, but they said, how do you cut around my ears? I said, well, then you hold the mask on your face and we take unhook it. So...
And that's what it's all been about.
Yeah.
Just the whole idea of being able to make it work because, well, that's what we have to do in this day and age. Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
And thanks to our friends at WILN-TV for helping set up that interview with Barbara Stempel so we could get a firsthand account of what it's like to be back in business. Speaking of business, State Senator John Udichak and Representative Aaron Coffer, supporters of House Bill 732, hailed passage of that bill earlier this week, calling it landmark legislation that establishes the Local Resource Manufacturing Tax Credit Program. They held a news conference after the announcement, and we have the details. First up with comments, State Senator John Udichak.
Thank you to my colleague over in the House and my friend from Luzerne County, Representative Coffer. A historic day in Pennsylvania, historic week, putting together a bill that had a very difficult time through the General Assembly and suffering a veto from the governor. This originally started as House Bill 1100, has evolved into House Bill 732, and after great negotiations with the governor's office, I have to give a lot of credit to Governor Tom Wolf and his team. They were invested in the idea of creating manufacturing jobs and using Pennsylvania natural gas, our local natural resources here in Pennsylvania and specific to northeastern Pennsylvania, to create transformational economic growth. They're invested in that idea, and we had to go to work and find compromises on a bill that we could all agree on. And the labor community, the Pennsylvania Building Trade Unions, Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Marcellus Shale Coalition, Pennsylvania Chemical Council, all of these diverse groups that aren't always on the same page when it comes to public policy or when it comes to economic incentives to leverage economic growth, we were able to get all of those players to the table and negotiate a compromise, which has now passed the Senate 40-9, the House 163-38. They are overwhelming bipartisan numbers in both chambers. And the governor has indicated to the media he will support the legislation. For Representative Coffer and I, this is significant. I've born and raised in Luzerne County, the grandson and son of anthracite miners. And when the mining industry collapsed in northeastern Pennsylvania, unemployment soared. Soared up over 20%. We are now approaching 20% again. We are at 16% unemployment in Luzerne County, and our average wages are lower than any other metropolitan area in the Commonwealth. We need this bill. Our working families in northeastern Pennsylvania need this bill. We need the economic growth, the nearly 4,400 jobs that could be created through the creation of these four manufacturing facilities. It's been a great partnership. I think we have all the worker protections in place to make sure that these construction trade workers are paid prevailing wages on these construction projects. There are taxpayer protections in place to limit the tax credit to $6.6 million per plant. But most of all, there is protections for the future of the economy in northeastern Pennsylvania that will give working families a real shot at a fair wage, a good paying job, a good paying job that could help shape their families' fortunes and the fortunes of the communities that they live in. So with that, I'll turn that over to my friend and colleague, Representative Cuff.
This was certainly a team effort, and thank you for all your hard work that you've done. I also want to give credit to the governor as well for helping to get this through to fruition. This did not happen by accident. There was a lot of hard work to bring the diverse coalition together that we did to get this bill passed with such significant votes. Obviously, it's just passed in the House, passed in the Senate yesterday with overwhelming bipartisan support. And for the thousands of people who will benefit their jobs from this legislation that we have passed, this is truly significant for Northeastern Pennsylvania and for working families in the Commonwealth. I'm excited for what we have that lies ahead. And I really believe that as somebody, when I first started working on this bill, you know, I proposed this when I first started running for office in 2012 as using tax credits to help encourage manufacturing in Northeastern Pennsylvania, specifically in regard to the natural gas industry. We have worked for quite some time to bring this together so that we can get this done and make sure that we can encourage the jobs in not only Northeastern Pennsylvania, but throughout the rest of Pennsylvania as well. This is a win for the taxpayers. This is a win for working people. This is a win for manufacturing and supporting our supply chain in Pennsylvania and the United States. And this is going to help at the end of the day with a lot of the fertilizers and the farmers who will benefit from this. This is a win all around and just excited to have such a good support to get this done. So thank you once again, Senator Udichek. Again, I'm proud to call you a friend and glad that we're able to get this across the finish line and look forward to the governor's signature of it.
We're going
to
start off with Mark Levy. Mark, you may go ahead and ask your question.
Okay. Hi, gentlemen. I'm checking in quickly. I'm aware of projects that have discussed sites in Luzerne County and Clinton County. Are you guys aware of anything else that might be out there?
Mark, this is Senator Udichek. Yes, we're Clinton County is one project that, and Ellis Energy is another that is looking at a site in Luzerne County. They're the two that have been active in support of this tax credit, active in the planning stages of looking at developing one of these large facilities. As a condition of the bill, a minimum $400 million investment is required. So these are massive private investments in Pennsylvania, and a minimum creation of over 800 construction trade jobs and permanent jobs. That's significant. So having two out of a potential four that is allowed under this act, that was one of the limitations that we compromised on with the governor's office to limit this tax credit to four projects. If it's successful, as we fully expect it to be, that is a conversation for another day of other projects. But having two already interested in coming to Pennsylvania, and Ellis Energy was very clear as they were looking at states like Ohio and West Virginia. And West Virginia, by the way, had passed a bill similar to House Bill 1100 when ours was vetoed here in Pennsylvania. So having this tax credit in the toolbox of our economic development professionals, we already have two. I suspect that we're going to see many more looking with great interest in investing in Pennsylvania.
Ryan Blum. Ryan, you may ask your question.
Yes, Senator Udichek, you mentioned getting everyone around the table and coming up with compromises. What was it like getting those compromises, and what were some of the compromises reached?
Well, as I mentioned, I think even in the governor's veto message, there was an opening to compromise. They wanted to strengthen the prevailing wage language to make sure that enforcement was and compliance were part of the bill. We did that. We worked with the Department of Labor and Industry. We worked with the Pennsylvania Building Trade Unions to ensure that the Prevailing Wage Act, as it exists today, would apply to these projects. It's the first time in the history of Pennsylvania, that a tax credit is tied to the prevailing wage. So that's a significant win for our friends in organized labor. The governor fought for that, as well as Representative Coffer and I, who are great friends of the building trade unions here in Pennsylvania. But I give a lot of credit to my Republican colleagues in both the House and the Senate. That's not an easy vote for those supported by the business community, having prevailing wage tied to a tax credit. They stepped up, the Republicans in both chambers, and were part of that compromise. Getting a compromise on the fiscal impact was also very important. And again, limiting it to a total of $26.6 million. for the entire program for and limiting it to four projects, I think was significant in getting many of our Democratic members who had some concerns about the expansive nature of the tax credit. But the governor, Senate, and the House worked very well together. It's a complex bill. It's a historic bill. And for Northeastern Pennsylvania has the potential to be transformational in terms of economic growth. So it was hard fought. There was disagreement along the way, but in the end, the good old fashioned art of compromise won out. It doesn't often happen anymore to get Democrats, Republicans, and independents working together in Harrisburg around a simple and powerful thought. Pennsylvanians deserve a shot at economic opportunity and the local resource manufacturing tax credit that is part and parcel of House Bill 732. That's what it is in its essence. It's about giving working families a shot at economic opportunities that can lift their fortunes and their communities.
The Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association estimates that more than 4,400 jobs could be created through that legislation. Now, don't go away. When we come back, Intercom's Jason Barsky takes a look at the numbers from the CDC, or rather the numbers that are no longer going to the CDC.
Welcome back
don't
to
go
Special
away.
Edition.
Now, Intercom's Jason Barsky introduces us to Josh Naur.
He's currently a general partner for a company called JumpScale. He's a former White House advisor on science and technology, and I first heard of him when he was just a boy, because we went to middle school and high school together. We weren't close, but I was very aware of him, and he's gone on to great things. I want to welcome Josh Naur to the show. Good morning, Josh. How are you?
Good morning, Jason. How are you doing?
Good. I'm sorry I called you intimidating. Has anyone ever called you intimidating before?
No, not really. Maybe just the weeds in my backyard, but
gotcha.
That's about it.
Gotcha. The reason I have you on this morning, and congrats on all your success. You've done some pretty crazy things. I've mentioned you before. You invented one of the first flu trackers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That was what year? How long ago was that?
So that was 2009 during the H1N1 virus, the swine flu. And basically, I had a software company at the time that had the ability to do lots of data mapping and collection. And we were really frustrated that we weren't able to see where cases of the swine flu were popping up. And I was wondering, my wife and I were wondering, should we send our kids to school or not? So couldn't answer that question. So we ended up creating a system and worked with a bunch of epidemiologists to do it. And
interesting.
It was deployed globally.
See, around here, here's how we handle the same thing, because we're going through the same thing now with the COVID-19 coronavirus.
Yep.
We don't say we're going to develop a system. We just complain about it and fight with each other. It's a little It's a little bit more 2020, you know.
It's a very effective method of getting rid of a virus.
A little bit of sarcasm there. It's a Jersey sarcasm.
Yeah, sorry. I hope that's okay on your show.
It's all I do.
Yeah.
When in doubt, use sarcasm. But okay, so the Department of Health and Human Services spokesperson Michael Caputo told the New York Times that these new rules that they put into place would streamline data gathering when it comes to this pandemic. We're talking about, because the old system was hospitals and doctors, they would get the information, test results, they'd send them to the CDC, the CDC would then forward them off, correct?
Basically. So
okay.
What we're talking about, there's several different systems that we're talking about. There's test results of actual somebody has COVID or not. That actually goes through county health departments in the United States and rolls up. The data that we're talking about that has changed is data that's about hospital beds, ventilators, personal, the PPE, and the availability of that stuff at hospitals nationwide.
Gotcha. I talked about this on Facebook with you. I said, I have this tendency to ask the question and make myself go, oh, duh, I should have known that. And that's my...
That's okay. This stuff is really confusing, and you don't really know about it very much. You just hear the results of the data being collected because it's a system that's been in place. The CDC has had relationships with tens of thousands of hospitals nationwide. Every day at each one of those hospitals, somebody fills out a form on a website and hits submit, and it basically gets that data, goes into a database at the CDC. The CDC immediately makes that data, the raw data, available to researchers, and you and I could get it, but we wouldn't know what to do with it because it's our garbly gook. And then they take a little while and they analyze it and correct the data, which is something that's really important in data processing. And by corrections, I don't mean anything nefarious. This isn't like, no one's going, huh, we should up the number for that hospital. It's literally just fixing mistakes in data entry that happen.
How common are mistakes when it comes to something like this?
There's usually anywhere between a 10 to 20% error rate on initial data raw report, you know, raw data, and then over a course of days, that number will go down, usually down into fractions of a percent of percentage for any given data set. The CDC knows how to do this stuff.
Uh-huh.
They know how to do the correction on it, and it's really just making sure people are counting things the right way, and that when they type in a number, that they didn't make a mistake when they did it, and they look for outliers. There's all kinds of ways that computer science and statistics, math exist right. to figure this stuff out. It's literally not rocket science, and it's a system that wasn't broken. It was the least of our concerns during all of this.
Did an interview. You said this new system is, quote, very dangerous. Now, did the old system have flaws? And compared to this new system, why do you think it's dangerous?
Well, so here's the scoop. The most dangerous thing about this new system is that nobody knows anything about it. The reason they don't know anything about it is because it was just announced 48 hours ago. The implementation is expected immediately. So hospitals were given less than 48 hours notice to switch over to a new system that not one scientist, epidemiologist, or expert in the field has had any chance to review, look at, or test. It's done by a private company here in Pittsburgh, actually. Basically, that company got the contract to do it in a rush. There's been years of conversation about how to improve this national healthcare safety network, which is, as I said, been around for many years.
Mm-hmm.
People have talked about ways to improve it. The CDC has put forward all kinds of proposals, scientific review, all the blah, blah, blah process that has to happen. These guys came in and got a no-bid contract, no competition whatsoever. They were awarded the deal, and no one's ever heard of them. Literally, they have no standing in the scientific community. They have no standing in the data community. I will say, and one has to look at this, but, they are very, very large donors to a specific political party that happens to be in power right now.
Okay.
No idea if that's why they got a contract or not, but it is a very, very suspicious thing. And it's fixing a problem that isn't broken.
And there are plenty of problems with this virus still going around and cases popping up. What is your biggest fear that could come out of this? Is it that people would cherry pick the data and we would only see what they want us to see?
Yeah, so they've announced that they will not make the raw data public, and that basically only the processed, analyzed data, which will be released and run through the White House, will be the data that gets released. And so there is politics involved here, obviously, but this isn't about politics. The concern isn't about politics. It's about science and the fact that, my kids, I need to figure out if it's safe to send my kids to school again, right? We're having the same damn conversation, however many years later.
Yeah.
And we still don't have effective systems in place to not just track on a, detailed basis, but to follow guidelines and follow, common sense that, we're one of the only countries in the world right now that are dealing with this level of virus outbreak. All the other countries in the world, modern economies of the world, have figured this out. Their kids are going back to school. There's really simple things we should be doing. We have to be focused on that side of the equation. And, fixing a data system, and by the way, spending $10 million to do it when the entire budget for the entire department that other database sits in is double that, and realize that the $10 million is used just to measure five or six things that are happening at hospitals. Hospitals are still going to have to report into the other CDC system for all of the other things that it has been tracking for many years. This data we're talking about has only just started being collected in March, right, because it's related to the coronavirus.
Right.
So it's just absolutely, this is an absurd thing to do, and it's dangerous because it doesn't allow for scientific review. And, it's like a trust, maybe, right? You can decide whether you trust the CDC or not, but guess what? With this data, you can verify, right? Anyone can look at the data and figure out what they think about it. This new system, that is not the case.
I'm just saying, now the CDC, they're only going to get the data after it's processed through the administration, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And by the way, they weren't even notified that this was happening. Like, this is how poorly and chaotic this is all put together. And, you know, I deal with, on a regular basis, I'm not a medical guy, I'm a business guy, and I deal with, you know, I help businesses, you know, grow and plan and strategize and all that stuff. And this feels a lot like other programs that have just been rushed out the door, like the PPP or other types of loan programs that just, you know, were just thrown out there without any thought as to what the consequences or implementation plans would actually be.
And how they are actually going to make it work.
And let's just not even get into the fact that, you know, I mostly work with small to medium-sized businesses. I'm not like some big corporate dude. So, like, you know, the businesses that I'm working with are like restaurants and, you know, local pet stores and, you know, things like that. And basically, those businesses have been completely screwed, not just by the virus itself. And yes, I know people in Pennsylvania argue about whether, you know, Governor Wolf and all that other stuff, right? But the fact of the matter is that consumers are not willing to go to stores as much as they were. People are scared. There's a lot of uncertainty. And opening a business right now and keeping a business open costs a lot of money, a lot of cash that small business owners don't have. And uncertainty and the sort of like chaotic noise that's coming from, you know, from the White House in Washington, D.C. and from our local governments is just making it almost impossible for businesses to be able to know what's going on around them. And, you know, it's making it impossible for local businesses to operate. And this is what is gutting our economy. And as that PPP is running out, which is what's happening right now, and people are coming off unemployment, and the unemployment benefits are coming to an end right now, we are headed for what a lot of economists believe, and I'm certainly seeing it on the ground, is going to be the death, literally the death of millions of small and medium-sized businesses around this country. And yeah, Pennsylvania is going to be hit as, you know, as hard as anybody else.
What if you could implement one or two things to change that, what would it be?
I'm, as I said, I'm not an expert on all these things, like, you know, but any of us can actually look at logic and look at what other countries are doing. And countries, especially in Europe and Asia, that have implemented mask wearing, which is really simple cloth mask that we all just wear, right? Mm-hmm. It protects other people around us. And basically, mask wearing and social distancing, if we do that, it is proven in other economies around the world that you can turn this thing around.
Gotcha.
So let's just do that. Let's stop all this other, you know, noise.
Yeah, I have a question for you, and I'm curious to hear your response to this. And do you have an agenda? And if so, what is it?
My agenda is literally, I just want the economy back. Can we please just get our economy back? Can we get some common sense going? And can we just wear some damn masks, socially distance, so that the people I work with can, you know, the businesses I work with can, you know, start operating at full strength again? Right now they can't. And I don't think there's any argument. I don't see how anyone could argue that fact.
Yeah. We'll watch this and we'll see how this goes. I saw this and I thought, this is weird that we're cutting out the CDC.
There's a URL. You can go to the CDC website and you can literally look at the raw data that people are typing into terminals at tens of thousands of hospitals nationwide. Mm-hmm. And you can draw your own conclusions if you want to. That is scientific process. That's the best way that we all in this world know how to collect and publish this type of data. Yeah. That isn't happening anymore, you know, with this new system, and that's bad.
We are wearing masks. I know we're split on this. We fight about weird things in this country. I don't see what the big deal is, but other people say if you wear masks, they're going to make you wear, like, special underwear. And I'm like, well, maybe the special underwear is comfortable. I don't know.
You have to wear pants to get into, you know, to go out in public or you get arrested. So, like,
not the way I shop.
You know, so
not
be it.
Not the way I shop. Josh Naur, what's the name of your company? It's Jumpscale.
Jumpscale,
right?
Yeah.
All right. Do you want to give out your website or anything like that?
Yeah, it's wejumpscale.com. Right, we work with small, medium-sized businesses to help them grow.
All right. Very cool. Hey, good talking to you.
Thanks for listening to Special Edition, a weekly look at the issues in the news and the personalities shaping the stories, a production of Entercom Communications.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.